Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
Today we are delighted to be joined by food writer Sky McAlpine. Sky, who joins us today from Venice, is a columnist for the Sunday Times and the author of two cookbooks. Her first cookbook was A Table in Venice, and her second cookbook, A Table for Friends, is going to be released next week. Sky, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited. Sky, we'll start where we always start on this podcast, despite the fact we're recording remotely, but we've managed to get you in Venice, which is nice. What are your earliest memories of food when you were growing up?
Gosh, where to start? Almost all my growing up memories seem to centre around food. But I think my earliest memories are eating with my parents. They seem to always have people round for lunch or for dinner. It was never just the three of us eating. There was always kind of a gang. So I think my earliest memories probably before we moved to Venice, when I was absolutely tiny, because we moved to Venice when I was six. So I probably was about maybe three at the time. At the time we had a house in Hampshire. And I just remember my parents would host these kind of amazing Sunday lunches that kind of started early in the day with all the cooking and kind of morphed into the evening. And we'd do these lovely, like, long tables. I was just a toddler, so I was sort of at lunch, but not really at lunch. And I'd kind of pop in and out and come and help myself to bits on the table and sit on someone's lap for a bit and then potter off and then potter back. And it was always such a happy time with people and chatter and lots and lots and lots of food. And I think that's probably kind of where my love of food started from, associating food with this kind of happiness and conviviality.
Who was the cook in your family? Were both your parents equally chefy or one more than the other?
So both my parents cooked. My mother at the time, this is before we moved to Venice, so when I was really tiny, had a food shop on South Audley Street, kind of a delicatessen called Hobbs, where she kind of imported French and Italian food to London. And this was in the late 70s, very, very early 80s, when that was still quite a novel concept and quite hard to get hold of all these kind of ingredients and bits and bobs. So she loved food, and Sunday lunch would often involve kind of things that were left over from the shop that would have gone off, wouldn't have made it through to the following week. So we always got to enjoy them on Sunday lunch. But my father loved cooking too, and he was always super involved. And he loved laying the table and kind of creating these amazing tables that were sort of heaving with bunches of herbs and bowls of fruit and flowers from the garden and plates of food kind of really over the top.
And the table's really important to you and your way of cooking now, isn't it?
It is. And I wonder if that comes from, I guess that's how I grew up, and it's always been a huge part of the ritual of eating for us has been the table that we sit at. My parents were never snobby about food. They always just loved good, simple food, but kind of always made a real effort with the table. And I think the table's such a great way of setting a scene. It's such a simple way, even if what you're eating is very, you know, basic. It can create this atmosphere of a party. And it's also creating an environment that people want to stay in, because the best meals, I think, are the ones that go on and on and on and last through the day and ideally onto the evening, and you're kind of having your fourth helping and it counts as dinner. So I think creating an inviting table, it plays a big part in creating that atmosphere.
And you say you moved to Venice when you were six. I mean, what was that like? That must have been an amazing experience for a six-year-old to suddenly be introduced to Venetian cuisine.
It really was. It's a magical place to have grown up. I think especially now that I'm older and I have my own children, I really appreciate what a magical city Venice is, particularly for children. And when I was little, the tourism industry wasn't what it broadly is now, so it was really a very, very small town, and everyone knew everyone, and there are no cars, so you kind of had a huge amount of freedom. Just I was able, you know, age six, seven, to run through the streets by myself to go and see friends the other side of town without needing someone to accompany me. So I had a huge amount of freedom, which is kind of magical. And then obviously there are the boats and the old buildings, and it's kind of all like a treasure hunt. And then food wise I mean, Italy is magical when it comes to food, and I've always been very greedy, so I was very, very happy to be in Venice with lots of delicious things and lots of pasta and wonderful fresh vegetables and amazing ice cream and all these things to really get into.
And we often ask about school lunches and school dinners. What were Venetian school dinners like when you were little?
So school dinners were actually quite good. Basically, you go to school. This is at my elementary school, which was a sort of crumbling old convent behind Santa Maria della Salute. And school would offer the first course, the primo. So school would always make either a risotto or a pasta. And that would be made by the nuns and served at the tables. And then the expectation is that you would bring your secondo, so your second course. So everyone would come to school with these little, they're called tegamini, they're like a bit like tiffin boxes, these little metal boxes, which might have, you know, a veal scallop in there or maybe some sea bass with a few vegetables. And then they would offer yogurt and fruit and what have you for pudding. But I think for my poor mother, it was a bit of a shock because she kind of grew up in this culture of you send your children off to school and they feed them, and suddenly she found herself amidst this competition of needing to produce good food every day in a little box on top of everything else.
You've got two boys, are they at school age yet, either of them?
We've got two boys, one's 1 year old, so he's still tiny, and our eldest Ines is at school, but he's at the French school in London, although they seem to have amazing meals, but they are provided by the school.
So you don't have to make tiffin boxes of veal scallops yet.
I look forward to the day.
And did your mother learn to cook Italian dishes when she was out there?
So she, when she was in her early 20s, she lived in Rome for a few years and fell completely in love and learnt to speak Italian. And I think that's where her real interest or her discovery of Italian food came from. And then I guess she worked in that field when she lived in London before I was born, and then when I was tiny. And then when we moved here, she just really embraced it. And we've always eaten Italian at home. I mean, very occasionally we'd have very special treats like English sausages, which you can't get here, so someone would have to like bring them from London. So we'd have guests come and stay, and it was always an amazing day if someone came with sausages and they'd kind of go in the freezer and then be rationed out one at a time.
Are they better than Italian sausages, do you think?
I prefer them because they're different. Italian sausages are quite fatty, and there isn't really the same culture of eating sausages in the way we do in England. So they tend to be more, you might have them on skewers with herbs and some vegetables or something like that. So I always loved English sausages. And then the other thing, there was this one little shop in Venice that sold really random collection of bits and bobs and some imported goods. And there, very occasionally, you would be able to buy at exorbitant expense Campbell's tinned tomato soup. And so that was also another great luxury. And I still love Campbell's tinned tomato soup, I think because it literally just tastes like a very, very special treat for me.
And when did you start cooking?
My parents always cooked. It never occurred to me that you wouldn't cook. We're always in a household where food was hugely important and very much part of life. So at 18, I left home to go to university in England. And there I suddenly found myself away and at home. So in my first 2 years I lived in college, and so it was college food, which was quite a cultural awakening. And then in my third and fourth years I lived out of college and had access to a kitchen. And that for me was the moment when I really started cooking. For the first time, it was kind of me from beginning to end that was putting food on the table. And I absolutely loved it. I bought millions of cookbooks. I became kind of obsessed. I'd spend hours planning what we were going to have to dinner and who was going to join us for dinner and trying to persuade people to come over. That's when I really learned to cook.
And which cookbooks were you relying on at that stage?
So there's a book by Joanna Weinberg called How to Feed Your Friends with Relish that my mother gave me for Christmas, I think when I was like 19 or 20. And I absolutely, I mean, I still have my copy and it's like so splattered and covered in food and the pages stuck together. I loved that book and I cooked from that like a Bible. I also remember going into the Big Blackwells on Broad Street, and it was a friend's birthday and I wanted a recipe for a birthday cake, and I remember kind of going to the cookery section and finding Nigella Lawson's How to Be a Domestic Goddess and being like, oh my god, that's what I need, but with absolutely no irony, just kind of like that sounds excellent, I would very much like to be a domestic goddess. And I love that book and baked from that. I still do bake from that, lots and lots and lots.
Your facilities must have been pretty limited when you were starting out in college.
Especially in our third year, we lived actually on college accommodation, but not on the main campus. And it was in a sort of old, rather charming, but crumbling house that the college actually sold the following year. So we were sort of the last year group to live there. And no one really wanted to be there because it was a bit spooky and kind of crumbling. But I thought it was really romantic and I loved it. And that had like a tiny, tiny little kitchen with, I mean, a cooker that every time you sort of used it, you kind of wondered if the whole house was going to go up and in flames, but it was very tiny, but it sort of worked. And I had a tiny fridge in my room, and we didn't have a proper table, so we'd always sit, the bedrooms all came with these sort of wooden coffee tables. I'd borrow another coffee table from a friend sort of down the corridor of rooms and sort of join it to mine to create a larger coffee table for us all to sort of sit and have dinner parties at. So it was really basic, but I loved it. And I think in a way learning to cook there was a good place to learn to cook, because from the very beginning I understood that you don't actually need a snazzy kitchen to create a meal that you can be really proud of and that you can really enjoy. It's about learning to, or understanding your space and its limitations, and then working within that. And kind of at university is the time when, you know, cooking anything at all feels like a huge achievement. So if you go wrong, no one judges you, and you don't feel so badly about it. So it was kind of a great time to, you know, I have two tiny little hob rings, so I wasn't going to make a menu that involved lots of pots bubbling away on the stove because there wasn't space, or there wasn't much fridge storage, so things would be done at the last minute, or I wouldn't make something that needed to then be stored in the fridge after. So I kind of learnt those lessons from the very beginning.
And you started your blog whilst you were doing your PhD at Oxford. How did you make that leap from academia into writing about food?
So I did my undergrad at Oxford, and then when we finished, my husband and I met in Freshers Week at Oxford, and then when we left university, he started work in London and I did an MA and then a PhD at UCL. And whilst I was there, we had our son kind of towards the end of my PhD, and so I took a year's maternity leave. And during that year, because I had a little baby, but I kind of had a real desire, a craving to kind of do something that was just creative, that was just for me, that I really enjoyed, that I could completely switch off from. And so I started writing the blog then. I was really lucky, I kind of really enjoyed doing it, and I was lucky that a couple of people commissioned me to write a few pieces from there. And kind of by the end of that year's maternity leave, I realised that this could actually be a career, this thing that I loved doing so much, this great passion, I could call it work. So I went back to college and completed my PhD, but sort of knowing that I would love to do this afterwards, and kind of kept the two going in parallel. And then by the time I finished my PhD, I was working on my first book. So that kind of was a natural transition.
And by the time you were working on your first book, were you back living in Venice at that point?
So by then, I'd fallen into this rhythm of spending about half the year in London and half the year in Venice. And my husband was working in London, but he was travelling a lot and working very long hours. So I kind of had this flexibility and this freedom. And because I had done my MA and my PhD, I wasn't tied to a single place. I was able to work from anywhere. So kind of moved between the two. So I missed being in Venice and really wanted to spend more time here. So it was kind of between the two. And the idea for the book was, I felt that all the books that I had on Venetian food had a real focus, but always broadly from the perspective of people who loved Venice or had spent, you know, a few months here, and were mostly focused on more restaurant-style food or the dishes that you eat in restaurants. And I felt that I'd grown up with such an incredibly rich tapestry and language of food that was Venetian home cooking, that sort of wasn't particularly glamorous and no one shone a shiny, jazzy light on it, but to me felt very special and very precious. So that was kind of the idea for the book.
And what is it that characterises Venetian home cooking?
Well, it's a lot of fish, obviously, because we're on the sea. And interestingly, a lot of spices, which is quite unusual in Italian food. Normally, you kind of, if you think most other regions, spice isn't a flavour that you associate with Italian food or with any region of Italian food. But Venice almost is its own little country, really, within Italy. And it has this wonderful history of the spice trade and being at the start of the spice route. So kind of those flavours from that history permeate the way we eat now. So there's that I think is quite interesting. And then also because Venice was occupied in the 19th century by the Austrians, 18th, 19th century by the Austrians. There's a lot of patisserie, and the Spritz, for example, is an Austrian legacy. So they're kind of these flavours. It's a bit of a melting pot.
And when you come back to London, where do you head to first? What's your sort of go-to restaurant?
God, I'm going to be really boring and say like the River Cafe or something like that. I love the River Cafe. I love Spring, Sky Ginchill's restaurant in Somerset House. For me, those flavours. And that I love because it's British food, but so elegant and so light and delicate. And then I always love kind of going for Japanese, Thai, Chinese, which you can't get in Venice. In Venice, it's all Italian food. So I kind of love those flavours that I would never be brave enough to cook at home.
Actually, where do you go when you're in Venice if you're going out for a meal? Or do you tend to go out for a meal?
In the summer, like at the moment when it's really hot, kind of really tend to focus on places where you can sit outdoors because it's just so lovely. So where do I love? I love Harry's Dolce, which is on the Giudecca, and it's the sort of a summer restaurant for Harry's Bar. And everyone always gives Harry's Bar a terrible time, but I kind of love it. It's unchanged in the 30 plus years that I've been here, and the food is absolutely amazing. And Harry's Dolce, you sit on the water and you look back on Venice. So it's kind of one of the most magical views in the world. And they do this unbelievable cake that's torta alla meringata, and it's layers of fluffy, 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 soft Genoese sponge layered with a sort of whipped cream folded with zabaglione, and then the whole thing is sort of covered with soft Italian meringue and kind of burnt, so it goes all marshmallowy. And I would travel very far for that alone. Where else do I love? There's a fantastic restaurant near my mother's house called Al Corvo, which is a small little Venetian restaurant. And in the winter, it's tiny and really cozy and you sit inside. And in the summer, they put a few tables in the square outside. And they do just incredible, just seasonal Venetian traditional food, but they always add their own little twists. So they do like these delicious deep fried zucchini flowers, but they fill them with ricotta and mint, and they're just insanely, unbelievably good. And then they do, in the winter, I love, they do an incredible pasta fagioli, kind of the bean and pasta stew, but then they put chunks of cotechino, kind of like Italian style sausage, in it, and it's just so good. I love it there. And then, you know, I love, there's a little pizza place around the corner from my mother's house called Pizzeria da Paolo, which is in this beautiful square called Campo Arsenale, just magical to sit out there. And there's nothing particularly special about it, but we've been going there since I was 5 years old or something. And they're incredibly friendly, and their pizza's absolutely delicious. Their pasta's incredibly good. Their tiramisu is really good, and it's a family-run business. And Paolo runs the restaurants and kind of potters around singing at everybody, and his wife, Odina, is in the kitchen making the same tiramisu she's been making for 30 years. So that's kind of magical for me, anyway.
Your new book, A Table for Friends, is subtitled The Art of Cooking for 2 or 20. What made you want to write about hosting for that number of people? It's more than a lot of people be brave enough to have over for dinner. Tell us about that.
So I will often have 20 people over, and if you saw the size of our kitchen, especially at our old flat before we moved to a larger place, you'd kind of be like, how do you even fit 20 people in there, let alone cook for them? But I sort of take the view that, you know, if you go over to someone's house, you don't mind being squashed up. It's really nice to kind of all be in there together and enjoy each other's company, and it's not meant to be perfect. It's my home, and you know, I just want to enjoy their company. But whenever I do have friends over for these mass parties, they're kind of like, oh my God, this is so stressful. How do you do it? And really, I feel like once you know those few small tricks that make your life easier, it is so simple. If I can do it, anyone can do it. It's just knowing what to cook, how to get your timings right, kind of being a little bit organized. So I really wanted to try and write a book that would encourage other people to embrace that, because I love doing it so much. And I feel that my life is so much richer for enjoying the company of friends in that way. I want to try and help others find their way to doing that as well.
I love the fact that in the book you say, you know, there are all these rules about hosting and you can just ignore all of them.
Completely.
The idea, you know, don't serve cream twice. You're like, well, I love cream.
Exactly. I mean, I do love cream. I think, honestly, cream three times is a win.
If you were giving someone a very sort of brief summary of your book and you were saying this is what you should cook, if you've got people coming around, you haven't really thought that morning what you're going to cook, what would be your sort of ideal dinner party meal to cook?
My favourite dinner party meal is probably like a really good roast chicken with some really, really simple roast potatoes, a fabulous salad, and then a really, really good pudding. But I think if you haven't thought about it before, it's kind of what you have in the fridge. And so there are a lot of either what you have in your fridge or what you can kind of throw together really quickly. So there are a lot of recipes in the book that don't involve any cooking whatsoever. They're more about assembling ingredients, which I really like because I kind of think you could have a quick flick, settle on something, and then go by the shops on your way home from work and throw those bits together. So things like, you know, one of my favourites is burrata with just a few bits of preserved lemon scattered on top and some olive oil and some fresh herbs. And it's so delicious and it looks so beautiful and it literally takes all of, I mean, if 5 minutes, if that, to prepare. And everyone always really loves it and kind of, it's like, oh my God, this is so good. So kind of there are lots of dishes like that in the book. What do I love for a quick fix? I mean, there's a recipe for lemon spaghetti that I love at the moment, which is just spaghetti cooked with a lemon sauce, which is basically just lemon juice, some zest and cream. So that's very quick to throw together. And I'll usually have pasta in the house. I'll usually have a bowl of lemons and I'll usually have cream, or I can certainly pick it up from the corner shop on my way home. And then for pudding, God, I love fruit and cream. Going back to the theme of cream, I love making meringues. I think that's a great, you know, usually have eggs in the house. They take 5 minutes to whip up. They do take, you know, an hour or so in the oven. But even if you put them in the oven before you sit down to dinner, and then by the time you finish dinner, they'll be ready. Maybe with some cream, maybe not. Just maybe dusted with some cocoa powder, something like that.
Yum. And have you noticed much of a difference between a London dinner party and a Venetian dinner party?
Yeah, so Venetian dinner parties tend to be more laid back. It kind of tends to happen, you know, that morning you'll get a text message from someone saying, do you want to come for supper tonight? Or maybe sort of 2 days before. It's more spontaneous, perhaps. You know, there's a tradition of these big plates full of food. It's kind of a traditional way of doing things. If they have a dinner party, it tends to be more of a thing. It's more of a commitment for them from a time perspective, etc. And I just think it's nice to keep things simple.
You don't do starters, do you? In keeping with that simplicity. Tell us about your vendetta against... It's not a vendetta. Tell us why you don't do starters.
So I don't do starters just because a few times I kind of caved to the social pressure to do a starter and I do it. And then we just all sit down and we're all enjoying our starters and then everyone's sort of finished and you've got to get up and clear away all the plates and then bring out the next course of food. And it kind of makes it all feel too much like work. Once I've cooked, I want to just sit down and enjoy being with everyone else and relax completely. And then, you know, you've got all your dirty plates. Do you stack them in the dishwasher or do you stack them on the side? And then they're just staring at everybody whilst they eat. And it's just, it feels like a lot of effort for, in my view, relatively little return. I'm kind of very big on low effort, maximum return. So I think rather than doing a starter, I'd just rather have an extra big plate full of food on the table all at once. I also think it's so nice, like the best feeling in the world is when you sit down to lunch or dinner at a big table and it's just heaving with food. How can I move because there's so much food here, or where do I put this big plate? So I love that feeling and I think it's so beautiful and so special, and that's what makes you feel really welcome and really excited to kind of tuck into that meal. And then I never cut the pudding though. I mean, I have a really sweet tooth. I'd be so upset if I went for dinner and there was no pudding.
What about drinks? What do you tend to serve for drinks? You must have pretty good wine in Venice.
So I'm quite a philistine when it comes to wine, so I always just kind of have something really simple, usually Italian. I'm very keen on Prosecco, kind of have bottles of Prosecco when everyone arrives. Sometimes I'll do a fun drink like you know, jugs of Negroni or, you know, like a cheats martini type thing to make it a little bit fun. Again, I really like jugs and I think keeping it really simple, you don't really want to be doing lots of different drinks for different people because it just becomes a bit of a headache and then you're rushing around trying to top everyone up and it's very confusing.
And what about when you're not hosting? What do you eat when you're alone? What's comfort food for
you? Oh my gosh. So my ultimate comfort food probably is risotto, because I just love that. My mother always used to make that for me on Sunday nights. I get really bad Sunday night blues, and I still do actually. And she would always make risotto, and I kind of loved it. So that buttery smell of the onion and the butter is just, for me, smells like comfort food. I should usually make saffron risotto. That's my favorite. Yeah, I mean, any risotto will do, but if it's just me, I'm really lazy, I'll kind of do toast and Marmite, or toast and, you know, some chopped tomatoes with a bit of olive oil, or like a boiled egg. and toast, recurring theme, but keep it really, really simple. I've really noticed I love cooking for other people, and for me that whole ritual is about the people more than it is about the actual food. It's quite interesting because my husband's the complete opposite. You know, he'll come home from, if he comes home from work late, like at 10 o'clock or something, and I've gone to bed, he will cook himself, you know, like a really quite elaborate pasta dish or something like that and really go to the effort. But he very rarely cooks for friends, whereas I'm the complete opposite. I love cooking for other people, and if it's me, you know, I'll just have leftovers or something very happily. And I quite enjoy that. There's a sort of slightly naughty feeling that comes with Marmite on toast for supper.
And what about your children? What do you tend to cook for them?
So I've always been quite lazy in that way. I just cook for them what we eat, and they seem happy enough. But they, you know, they have their favourites. Like Aeneas absolutely loves pasta con pesto. So sometimes as a special treat, you know, I'll make that with the green beans and the little bits of potato and everything in the sauce done the proper way, like they do in Liguria, and he loves that. And sometimes, you know, like certain cakes that I bake, he really loves, so I might make that for him as a special thing. The little one is still so little, he just kind of eats purees and bits and bobs.
And you have a sweet tooth. I mean, do you have a favourite pudding? Can you choose one?
Really hard. Honestly, that's a really hard question. What do I love? I mean, I love cake. In A Table for Friends, I possibly would say that my favourite recipe at the moment is there's a recipe for pistachio butter cake. I do it with a kind of marzipan buttercream icing, and it is, I have to say, insanely yummy, and I'm completely obsessed. You know, kind of you go through phases in life. This is definitely my pistachio butter cake phase. So I love that. And I could, you know, kind of eat that for breakfast, lunch and dinner for a very long time. But, you know, I love all puddings. God, I love meringues. I love really good chocolate cake. I'm particular about, it has to be a really good chocolate cake. I tend to prefer like flourless chocolate cakes that are kind of more fudgy and a bit more brownie-like rather than a spongy chocolate cake. There's also a recipe for coffee walnut cake in the book that I love. You know, so that kind of panna cotta I love and have a lot of, again, cream, ice cream. I mean, honestly, I could go on.
And Skye, just to finish, we often ask people what their sort of desert island dish would be. We can give you a whole, you can have a starter if you want, you can have a main, and you can of course have a pudding. What would you go for?
Oh, so if I can have a starter and I'm not cooking it, I'm very keen to have a starter. Really good prosciutto melone, I love, and I don't think you can beat, you know, when the melon's really, really sweet and the prosciutto's very, very thinly cut and salty. So I'd probably start with that. And then I might have a primo. So I'd love spaghetti with lobster and tomato, but sort of buttery tomato sauce. And then I would love, oh gosh, some kind of, maybe just like a really, really good steak with really, really good chips, kind of barbecued steak, and like a really nice crisp salad or something like that. And then for pudding, I think I'd have to go with a slice of the pistachio butter cake with marzipan icing, and maybe like a scoop of ice cream.
Well, we can arrange all of that. Skye, it's been such a pleasure to have you on Table Talk. Thank you so much for joining us from your beautiful Venetian home.
And Skye's new book, A Table for Friends, The Art of Cooking for 2 or 20, is out now with Bloomsbury.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.